You have no clue what they're talking about, so just keep your mouth shut and don't say something stupid, like you always do.
Oh my God, you can't be more awkward. Please don't be awkward.
People are too nice to tell you you're failing.
No one is taking you seriously.
You could have gotten it done faster. You could have done it the first time.
No one notices, so why even bother?
We all feel like we're not good enough sometimes. Experts call it imposter syndrome. And this feeling of self-doubt is fairly universal. In fact, nearly 70% of Americans struggle with it. So why are these feelings so prevalent? Where do they come from, and what can we do to overcome them? Welcome to She Wonders, produced by Bright House, where wondering leads to wonder, and wonder can change the minds of the people who can change the world. We're bringing together leaders in business and life to discover new insights to workplace issues. I'm Judy Oh, Strategy Director at Bright House and your host. On today's episode, we'll explore what imposter syndrome is, who it impacts, and what organizations can do to help. Our guest today is Adia Gooden. She's a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute in Northwestern. And we're also joined by Chip Gross, Managing Director at Bright House. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much. Happy to be talking with you.
Likewise, really happy to be here today and looking forward to the conversation.
We wanted to start from first understanding, what do we mean by imposter syndrome? Can you define that for us, Dr. Gooden?
Sure. So imposter syndrome is the phenomenon of feeling like a fake or a fraud despite evidence of high achievement. People who experience imposter syndrome generally tend to feel like they're not good enough, like nothing they do is good enough. And they're often sort of constantly questioning their achievements or attributing their success to luck or chance or someone not really knowing what they can do and them sort of tricking other people into thinking they're capable. I know we call it imposter syndrome. It's not a diagnosable disorder, but more sort of a collection of things that people experience that has become pretty common among high achievers in today's society.
So where do you think this sense of imposter syndrome comes from?
I think that's a really good question. I think it can come from a number of places. I think for some people, it comes from a belief that in order to succeed, it should be easy for you, right? So you shouldn't have to work hard to get a good grade, to get a promotion, et cetera. And some people have been sort of socialized since they were kids to believe that they're just smart or just intelligent and they don't have to work hard for their achievements. And so when they start facing challenges and they have to start working hard for things, then they assume that means that they're not actually smart, that there's something wrong, that things are taking extra effort. I also think generally in the U.S., particularly with the prevalence of social media, we sort of have this fantasy that people are successful overnight and something magical happens for those people who are famous or successful or really impressive. And what that does is it takes away our understanding of the process and the work and the effort and the years sometimes that it takes for people to build themselves to their levels of success, right? So when we have a fantasy that people are overnight successes and we ignore that they've spent 10 years playing basketball day in, day out to develop their skill, then we overlook the fact that in order for us to be successful, it would also be normal for us to have to work that hard.
And Chip, I look at you. You joined Bright House with decades of experience. You're a figure of authority and power and experience in my mind.
Flattery will get you everywhere, Judy.
I can't imagine that you would experience something like this. But I'm curious. Have you experienced it before? What was your first memory of it?
Sure, definitely. And I think a lot of the points that Adia highlighted resonate really personally with me. I think from my vantage point, imposter syndrome's been something that I think has almost just been like a way of life for me in a way. I mean, from the earliest memories that I have and being an African-American male, I mean, I remember going to stores with my mother and younger brother. And, you know, me and my brother almost used to make a game out of it where we go into a store and we could immediately feel this sense of people questioning whether we should be there or not. Almost to the point where, you know, my brother and I would go in the stores and we'd like separate. And we'd watch, like, the reaction of the security guard, try to figure out, well, who should I be tailing versus the other? And it was just that ongoing feeling of always being in a place or a space that wasn't necessarily, you know, where I wasn't expected to be or where, you know, my presence caused a disproportionate reaction to other people who would have entered the same venue.
Yeah, it sounds like there are so many cultural nuances to having people experience this imposter syndrome. I wonder, are there factors that make us more prone to it?
Yeah, so sort of referencing back to what I was sharing earlier about kind of how imposter syndrome comes about, imagine if you are a woman and you were really into your STEM classes, but every time you showed up to a STEM class, an advanced placement STEM class, let's say, you were one of the only women. And there's a little bit of a communication there implicitly that this class is for men. And then you find that when you share a comment in your class or in your research lab, it may be overlooked, right? But when John shares his comment, everybody thinks it's amazing, even though it's similar, right? And so these can be implicit messages. You don't really belong here because there aren't other people who look like you in this space. So you can imagine that if you're getting those implicit messages and you're internalizing them, that then that would interact with and feed into the sense that you don't belong in that space, right? That, you know, if people really knew you, they wouldn't think you belonged there and that you're not smart enough, you're not good enough to be there. And it might make you question, especially in our current age of increasing the diversity in the STEM field, which I think is a wonderful thing, right? But if that narrative is, well, we need more women in STEM, we need more women in STEM, without a real, you know, thoughtfulness about the fact that women provide richness in these environments, then you can feel like, well, they just let me into this class or this program because I'm a woman, not because of what I know or what I can do. And so that all feeds into feeling like you're an imposter and you don't belong. And the same can be true for people of color, for first people in their family to go to college. So these sort of historically marginalized identities can feed into and sort of make imposter syndrome more likely because there are sort of messages that are coming that are saying, you don't belong here. And that can be hard to navigate.
Chip, what does self-doubt sound like for you? I mean, do you have moments when you hear a voice in your head that might make you feel imposter syndrome?
Without question, I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't feel like in some way there's something that you know, I have to wrestle with that makes me have to take a step back and reflect on why I feel the way that I do. And I think in some ways it may not necessarily be a voice. It may just be that feeling in the pit of your stomach that you're about to do something where there's a risk of you not excelling. And I think like Adia was saying, in some ways that almost becomes self-actualizing. And I think for me, the way that I try to cope with that is think about where I've been successful before and trying to take what is in some ways kind of an unfounded or an unknown fear and make it a known quantity in terms of what is the consequence if this doesn't go well? Is it something that's going to matter in a day or in a month or in a quarter or in a year? And I think being able to recognize that every day you live, there are going to be things that don't go the way that you expect them to go, but the fact that you're here day in and day out shows that you survive and that you have ways of excelling, moving beyond the things that may give you short-term setbacks if they even happen. And I think that's the way that I'm able to keep things in their proper place and not let it get to a point where it's paralyzing or gets to a point where I start to believe that there is this sense of being an imposter or not being legitimately in the place that I should be. And I think that's the way that I really try to, you know, to work through that.
Yeah, if I could just comment on that, if that's okay. You know, I think that that's a really good approach. I think it sort of involves taking perspective, right? So putting any given situation into perspective, because sometimes our minds can make a given challenge seems so big, but when we step back, we're like, you know, it's really not that big of a deal if this or that doesn't go very well. I think some of the things that I encourage people to do when I'm working with them in therapy or in workshops on things like this are to, one, focus on process more than outcome. I think we're a very outcome-oriented society, right? So did I get the raise? Did I get the promotion? Did I get the ABC, whatever. And what I encourage people to do is think about, how do you want to show up to this challenge? And how can you feel proud of the way that you show up and the way you engage in this process, even if the outcome isn't what you hoped for, right? And so shifting from this outcome focus to a process focus, what did I do? What did I have ownership of? And how did I engage that agency I had in this process, and can help people shift away from self-criticism to more of self-reflection? And I also think it's really helpful for people to think about, what has gone well in the past, and what did I do to help that go well? So sometimes we can have this sort of magical thinking about our past successes. Oh, I just got lucky. And so I encourage people to think about, what did you do to prepare for that presentation that helped it go so well? It wasn't just that you had a good cup of coffee that morning and you were on. You did a lot of hard work to prepare. And when you notice and account for the processes that helped the success to happen, that means that you can do that again. You can use a similar process for a new challenge, and that can give confidence that you feel like, okay, this is going to go well. It's not just going to be up to luck.
I think that's great advice.
Yeah. I'm curious to know, from your perspective, Adia, how does specific feedback and thoughtful feedback play a role in helping us cope with imposter syndrome?
One of the key recommendations I have for people who are supervisors or leaders in an organization, very specific feedback about what was helpful, what was positive, is so useful, because it's really hard for people to discount it. And one of the things I recommend for individuals is to seek feedback from the people that, you know, their higher ups and the people they're working with. Mm-hmm. So if leadership has a fixed mindset, they're going to start assuming that their employees can't get better. And so then they're not going to give the feedback until it's too late, right? Or until you're starting to build a case for firing someone, which is very different than having a growth mindset as a leader and thinking about, how can you support your employees to be their best, to show up with all of their strengths and contribute them? And how do you coach them in that process, because you believe that that's possible?
Mm-hmm. So, Chip, I would love to hear from you. Have you had a leader in your life that has helped you feel more confident and more capable?
You know, my time with my parents and even grandparents, you know, they've really helped instill in me, a sense of, life is a beautiful struggle. And, there are going to be times when you feel like things are going really well, and there are going to be times where you're going to have setbacks. And I think while you may strive for perfection, you have to be comfortable and understand that, you are imperfect, and there are going to be times when you're going to do things that don't work out the way that you expect them to. You know, there's a statement that, one of my past managers used to say that, you only fail when you stop trying. You know, I may be in a room where I am the only person of color, or I am the only male, or, I'm the only person who's representing our agency, but, I've been in similar situations before. And I think over time, experience has helped also bolster that level of confidence that, you've excelled and you've been able to demonstrate that you do deserve to be in these places and spaces, and that, your presence there is something that adds value.
Yeah. And Adia, I mean, I would love to hear from you on why you think it's in the organization's best interest to help employees with a sense of imposter syndrome. In our guts, we know that's probably a really helpful thing to do. Can you give a sense for why it would be so important for organizations to pay attention to this?
you know, the anecdotes that I hear when I conduct these imposter syndrome workshops are really powerful to me, right? So one of the things I do is I have people imagine what their life would be like if they didn't feel like imposters. And then I have people share out, you know, what do they notice that would be different? And often the themes are, you know, I would be more free. I would ask more questions. I would contribute more of my ideas. I would, you know, go for things that I'm, you know, wanting to go for. I wouldn't shrink. I would show up, right? And if you think about it, you know, if organizations have a lot of people who are feeling like imposters and sort of shrinking, they are losing out. They are losing out on the talent that they are paying for if people don't feel like it's safe or don't feel confident enough to share their ideas or ask really important questions, right? And so if people are sort of just skating along and trying to go under the radar, organizations are necessarily missing out. Not only does an organization's commitment to helping people overcome imposter syndrome and creating an environment where people don't experience imposter syndrome benefit the individuals, the employees, and the students, it also benefits the organization because they will experience richer discussions and better problem solving and better question asking, right? And they will experience the benefits of the talents of everybody they have hired being brought to the table and used effectively.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't help but connect it back to what we do at Bright House. We believe that the purpose of individuals and organizations is at the intersection of their unique strengths and a need in the world they fulfill. And so I think this idea of articulating and discovering and living your strengths is such a powerful notion. And I was wondering, Chip, if you can share with us how you think about this journey of discovering, you know, one's personal purpose and how that can help combat some of this sense of feeling like you're a fraud.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of it is, you know, just like you were describing, you really have to have an innate understanding of who you are and what, you know, your unique talents are. And I think that's what leads to a lot of people falling prey to imposter syndrome, because they don't really have a good sense of, you know, their own uniqueness or the things that really bring them joy and, you know, make them happy and how those things then manifest themselves in the work that they do. And I think, you know, if you're going to search and feel like you're connected to the work that you do, you have to have an understanding of, you know, what you're bringing to it, as well as, you know, how the things that you're bringing are helping, you know, the collective become better. And everyone is going to have things that, you know, they maybe periodically doubt about themselves, but they also have to recognize that there are things that they have and that they add to the culture that, you know, are unique and, you know, don't necessarily fit, but are really important for them to, you know, understand and recognize that, you know, that's why they're there. Candidly, I think it's also a combination of getting to a point, you know, in your life where you don't care as much about what people think day in and day out, and that you're confident enough in yourself and the things that you've done. Even if people don't understand the way you do certain things or why you do certain things, that it's okay. And, you know, that's you uniquely being you.
Imposter syndrome really feeds off of comparison, right? Comparing yourself to other people and saying, they look so confident. She says that so amazingly. She has this. And feeling like you should be the same as them, right? And when you take a step back and look at it, you know, the world would not be better off if everybody was like X person. But it's easy to get caught up in that. And shifting the focus away from comparing yourself to others and towards, well, what are the unique strengths you want to bring? Can be really helpful. I think there's a challenge in that, you know, often in our traditional education system, there's really not a lot of space for young people to explore this question for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, what are you the best at? Take all the AP classes if you're a high achiever, get, you know, go to the best college, and then get the best job that pays the most money. And I think a lot of people go down that path and end up at the top of a ladder that they didn't really want to climb and then feel unfulfilled and unsatisfied. Mm-hmm. And I think this is especially true for people who are coming from more disadvantaged backgrounds. backgrounds, there's often not the space given to explore what is it that you love, right? What is it that you contribute to these spaces, and how do you follow that as a path? And I say that that can be more challenging for people from disadvantaged backgrounds because there is usually a more pressing need to make enough money to cover your bills, to pay back your student loans, and to support your family. And it would be great if more universities and high schools provided support and space for people to really explore this for themselves and then sort of pursue paths and passions that fit with their strengths and the needs that they want to try to address in the world.
You know, I'm just reflecting on this conversation with you both. And for me, it's really rare that I talk about imposter syndrome, especially in a professional setting.
Mm-hmm.
So to talk about it with my good friend, Adia, is one thing, right? And you're so helpful with your actual expertise in it. But to talk about it with, you know, my managing director, Chip, is another thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to hear from you both. Why is it that we don't talk about this more often? And how can we create more intentional space and opportunity for people to have these productive discussions around what we're experiencing and how we can cope with it?
I think one of the reasons that we don't talk about it is it takes a lot of courage to acknowledge that, you know, you aren't always, you know, successful, and that, you know, there are things that are going to happen over time that, you know, make you question your own, you know, success and question, in some cases, you know, your right to be in certain places. And I think, you know, for me and for Bright House, I think we have to continue to reinforce that, you know, we are not a cancel culture. You know, we're a culture of redemption, and that when people do have things that don't go the way that they expect, you know, we're as an organization going to help them become better and, you know, help them understand the things that they can do more effectively. But I think we have to be willing to help our employees be resilient and, you know, understand that it takes time to become better at anything, and you can't expect to always be at the top of your game. And I think for leaders, too, we have to be willing to show some level of vulnerability and also acknowledge when we as leaders may be struggling with something or maybe didn't do things as well as we hoped that we would have done them. And, we're all humans that are imperfect and trying to become better every day.
Yeah, I really agree with that last piece that Chip just shared. I think, you know, imposter syndrome, sharing and talking about it is something that really is best going to come from leadership, right? Because it sort of humanizes it and normalizes it. It sort of highlights that, yes, somebody can be very successful and a leader and still sometimes question themselves. I think, you know, one of the reasons that we're sort of just starting to have these conversations and we haven't had them as much before is because I think sort of overall as a society, and certainly this is true for organizations, we're sort of just getting around to thinking about, okay, how the way that employees, students, et cetera, feel internally, their mental health, their, you know, sense of wellness and being and sense of worth, how does that affect their work, right? I think before we were in an era where it's like, you know, you should just be doing the work. Don't really care what's happening internally. And if you can't do the work, then maybe you shouldn't be here, right? There wasn't really much of a curiosity about that. And I think we're moving now into a place of, okay, what is happening that might get in the way of somebody who's very talented and very smart, get in the way from them, you know, showing up and doing their best. And I think it does take courage. I think it mm-hmm. is vulnerable. And that's another reason why sort of leaders starting the conversation is helpful, because I think often when people feel that they are imposters, they feel like they are really the only ones. And so I think as we, you know, talk about this publicly, it helps people to be able to sort of come out of the shadows and share with other people mm-hmm. and then learn, oh, that person I think is really impressive also feels this way. And so that means that it probably isn't true that I am an actual imposter. It's just a feeling I have.
Adia, for the audience listening to this podcast, if they only have a couple of minutes to listen to it, can you give them the top 3 to 4 coping mechanisms of imposter syndrome they can walk away with?
Yeah. So I think acknowledging your accomplishments and the work that you did to achieve them is really important because it combats this idea that it's based on luck. Accepting affirmation from others is really important. Identifying your strengths and what you can contribute. And seeking concrete feedback from other people who have firsthand knowledge of what you do and how you do it and can give you good feedback on where you're at and how it's going. Those are some, I think, easy ways to work on overcoming imposter syndrome.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us today. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about imposter syndrome.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been great.
You got this. You're doing fine.
You're here for a reason. Things happen at the pace that they're meant to.
I'm kind. I work hard. I support people.
It's okay. All you have to do is slow down, breathe, go into a quiet room for 5 minutes and gather your thoughts, and you'll be fine. I promise.
Look, you are magic, the key. You're an integral piece of this puzzle, and your capacity to evolve is unimaginable.
Thanks for listening to She Wonders, produced by Bright House. Be sure to check out our other episodes where we explore issues such as work-life harmony and diversity and inclusion.